Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. Okay. So today's Saturday, so I have to suck on my thumb and come up with another talk. So I'll see what happens. I think it's about 5 weeks, 5 or 6 weeks into the rains. Oh, calming down, not talking so much, meditating a lot. Then I wake up. Ooh, must be fantasy. No, I think generally we are slowing down, and hopefully spending some of that time in stillness, or just being content with nothing happening. So I thought, you know, with the being a young senior monk, you always have a few things floating in your mind when you Saturday comes around. So, oh, what should I give a talk about? And usually it's a few talks, a few versions of the Saturday night talks. It's the morning version, afternoon version, and night version. And then the night version is completely different from every other version that comes up. So then I try not to think about it. Obviously, have a good meditation and see whatever comes up. But from time to time, people do ask, oh, Ajahn, why don't you talk about this? Or why don't you talk about that? So tonight, I think it would be a good time to talk about body contemplation. Because I know it's something that Ajahn Thun certainly talks a lot about. And that sometimes that is not talked about a lot from the Western monks and nuns. Maybe in the West, people think it was a bit too morbid to go on about pus and, you know, intestines and bones and stuff like that. But I think, especially in the Western context, because, you know, the everyday experience, the media, the magazines, the newspaper, the movies, we're so bombarded with sensual images of the body, lots of skin, lots of body parts that are supposed to be enticing. So I think a little bit of body contemplation will help even out the mind so that way it's not caught up in the appearance of skin. And and also Ajahn Mahabua talks about, you know, sometimes it's not always, the practice is not always, you know, banging on about the breath day in, day out. Although some persistence and focus is always helpful, but sometimes it's also helpful to use your contemplation to help calm the mind. So using reflection, using wisdom as a way to still the mind as well. And one of the ways is reflecting on the body. Reflecting on its unattractiveness, actually. Because we're always told that the body is very beautiful, something enticing. There's lots of attractive ladies on magazines, faces and skins, different and other body parts that we think are attractive, flashing. But when you think about it, you know, beauty is very, very skin deep, I was saying on Tuesday. You remove her skin or his skin, there's not much left that's attractive. The veins aren't very attractive. The muscles, when you take the skins off, are not very attractive. Not something that people fantasize about. And so it's good to remember that. And also, to remember, you know, I was reading somewhere, I think in Time magazine, they have this little factoid that they're like, you know, oh, you know, 8,000 kilos of meat is consumed every day, or, you know, there's 35 gallons of oil is being fried in every KFC every single hour or something. But anyway, one of these factoids that I thought was interesting was it says You know, there's in the U.S., I don't know whether it's very popular in Australia, but in the U.S. it's very popular. This is called the U.S. Sports? U.S.? Something, anyway. It's one of those big magazines, the swimsuit issue. Every year, there's a very big, everybody buys the swimsuit issue because you have very attractive ladies in it. But they said in this Time magazine, Factoid, that it takes 20 bottles of baby oil per one of these shoots. So, you know, they have these very attractive young ladies, but yet, to make her look even more attractive, perfect, they smear tons and tons of these kind of baby oil on their skin for each of these shoots. And can you imagine what goes into it? So you see your picture is very attractive. So, oh, you know, this person must look like this all the time. They walk around looking this great. But if you are involved in the, you know, in the advertising industry, you know that's not how it works. This poor lady is sitting there for hours and hours, and they're taking hundreds and thousands of pictures of this lady from different angles, lots of makeup in between, lots of funny poses. And then once they take that, they choose from 1,000 pictures, just one picture that she looks good in. And then they Photoshop that over. And there's a lighting, there's a makeup. So the body is so attractive, why so much work? You should just wake up, roll out of bed, sit in front of the camera, and you have a perfect shot. So obviously, the body is not as attractive as people, as you know, the advertiser would have us believe. That generally is pretty unattractive. You see this pretty young lady in the first thing in the morning, without her makeup, without her hair done, without the right lighting and the photoshopping, you find it not unlikely to buy that magazine. But, you know, after all this processing, and then obviously, you know, yeah, she becomes the dream girl, the girl of your dream that people fantasize about. So, you know, it's a good way to think, you know, behind the reality, you know, behind the kind of the superficial image that we're presented with, what the body is actually like. And I know sometimes, you know, what some people may be arguing that, well, you know, the body is just a body. It's not really ugly. It just does what it does. And obviously, in the ultimate sense of reality, it is true. The body is just the body. It's just, you know, meat, muscles, veins coming together, you know, digesting food, grows old. But I think because of this pull, because of the inherent nature of lust in our mind already, and then also because of the conditioning that we have in the Western context of looking at these things, that from time to time it is good to reflect on the nature of the body, that it is not all that attractive, and that and that's one way to look at it, is just to see what goes behind making these people looking good. Another way of reflecting on the body is also in, you know, and bringing that inside. That's the main thing, you know, to see your own body. That, you know, it brings us pleasure, obviously, through sight, smell, taste, and touch. But also, it's a large amount of stress and suffering around it, that we constantly have to please it. You know, have to bathe it, to feed it, take it to the toilet. You know, we don't bathe a couple of days because of the water shortage. It doesn't smell all that great. And then, you know, and also with the... and it's always looking for comfort. You know, it's too hot, too cold, too itchy. Sometimes you can't get to sleep because the body is too itchy. You toss and turn. You wake up slightly grumpy because you don't get a good night's sleep. And just reflect, yeah, I mean, this is what it's like to have a body. It's not, you know, we're constantly thinking about ways to bring more pleasure to the body, actually. So there's quite a lot of work involving having a body. So hopefully, and also, you know, like I say over and over again, when you have a body, since everybody here is, well, 90% of the people is over 30, after 30, you don't grow younger, you don't grow healthier, you only go the other way. And lots and lots of, you look at Lungta, remember Kagyeta, and you see what's ahead, American guitar is actually a very good, you know, considering all things, a very healthy person. He was quite energetic when we knew him about, 8 or 9 years ago, where he's running around, cutting trees down, chainsawing, building this, building that. But, you know, as the things go by, things are catching up, The hands don't work so much. They have their own life. They move wherever they feel like moving. They drop things when they feel like dropping it. And the knees don't work. Look for knee replacement. And this is a healthy, really healthy person. Imagine if you have, a not-so-healthy body when you get to be 60 or 70. It can be just pure suffering. And yes, when you're young, it brings you, some pleasure, lots of pleasure, but all is payback time as we get older and older. But hopefully, with meditations and the Buddhist teaching, we contemplate, and we expect as we get older, the body will be less energetic, that we encounter more health problems. And hopefully through expecting, through accepting, through making peace, that the mind doesn't get shaken by these conditions of the body, that there is peace, and there's some wisdom underpinning our practice. Because that's the thing, when you see older people, and they don't have the Dhamma, and they're constantly fighting, and they get very confused, angry, mad, because their body's not working. If only they had, some teaching of the Buddha saying, well, yeah, of course, that's what happens when you have a body. It doesn't work when you get to be 80 years old. So hopefully, bringing back, contemplating the body from a Dhammic perspective, we're bringing an inner sense of peace. That even if the body is not healthy, the body is weak, our mind isn't weak, that we can still be at peace. We can still be happy in spite of a sick body, which is not a common thing, but which is a great thing. Great skill that we could have. Great skill we can offer to other people when they see an old person, a sick person, but not a grumpy person, a happy person who's made peace. Another way, so that's one way, think of age and sickness. Another way was thinking of, body contemplating. It's also to look, even though we chant the 32 parts, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, skin, teeth, and all that. Those are traditional 32 parts that you could go through the body parts by parts and see which one kind of resonate with yourself. But you don't have to stick to the 32, you can pick any other parts of the body that is interesting. And that's all you do for one day, for a week. So look at people's nose. Everybody comes up, it's just a nose. The Pasadika's nose, Gunadona, it's just a nose. Not big, not small, just a nose. And look, that's all you see of people, and see what happens, what that does in the mind. All you know, focus. Everywhere you come to contact, every picture you look at, instead of looking at the overall picture, just look at one thing only. So that also helps to to kind of make a personality out of this, so-and-so is a person, I like this person, I don't like that person, or this person's like this. No, it's just a nose walking at you. It's just a nose standing in front of you. And seeing what happens. Because the traditional way, I forgot, the traditional way is taught in Thailand, so that people know. It generally is, samadhi brings panya, or you can use wisdom, panya, to help samadhi. And in regards to body contemplation, is that first, you calm the mind first. Then when the mind is calm, you bring up different parts of the body. But, and you do that as often as you can. But the practice really takes off is when through the stillness of your mind you have a nimitta, a visual picture of your body, and you start to break that down. Ajahn P. spleen, who is very good body contemplation. Well, he's good in everything, most meditation. His practice, you know, because of his great karma, his barmies that he built up over the many, many lifetimes, that he said his practice was very easy, very smooth, and very deep from early on. And when he did body contemplation, one of the things that he taught us was this way. He said it was like you have a picture book in front of you, and it's one of those like picture that overlaid each other. So you have imagine your body, that's what it's like, and then you imagine, you know, a dead body, your dead body. Imagine it's 5 days away, 10 days away. This is also what do you call it? Canonical, which means this is also described in the sutta as well. Use this picture, your decomposing body, over a couple of days, months, and year. You break from the body to lying there, you know, pus coming out, things going away, just a bunch of bones. The bones decompose to dirt, and the dirt gets blown away. There's nothing left. And then you put it back together. Dirt comes up, you have the body, you have this corpse lying there, and it comes alive again. And this is not to scare you, but because this is your body, so hopefully it's not too scary. But it's just to picture, you know, the reality of the body, something that the mind doesn't want to see. So we try to kind of bring it up and to work with it. And when your mind is still enough that it has a very clear picture of your own body in the mind, in your own mind's eye, going through this process in and out, backwards and forwards, then the practice really, really gets deep. And you start to, your lust you have towards the body and other people's body decreases tremendously, he says. And yeah, so it's something that you can also, it's another way to look at the body that you can also use as a tool to work for body contemplation. And like Ajahn Dhan said, there is, you know, 1,000 way, different ways to contemplate the body. Actually, body contemplation brings up a lot of happiness, brings up a lot of piti, he says, brings a lot of joy and interest in the practice, because there's so many ways that you can do it. Whereas anapanasati, if you get into jhanas, you go, hit the breath, hit the nimitta, bang, okay, and you come out. Okay, not so exciting. Maybe very peaceful, but not very exciting. Whereas body contemplation, with your visual, there's lots and lots of things you can do with the body. Lots of different ways you can imagine it. Ajahn Dhan used to have these visions when he see people. It's like a double, he said. You see people sitting there. But also he can see that there's a corpse there. Their corpse, decomposing in front of him. Obviously, if you don't have a strong, steady mind, you would think you're kind of crazy. But because he had a very strong study mind, that he knew that was, you know, the nature of reality, that was not something he wasn't crazy. He did, I think, ask Ajahn Chah initially when these things were starting to happen to him. But after a while, he obviously, you know, had the stability of mind to say, well, you know, this is, you know, part of reality. Our perception of the mind, you know, there's so many things that we can pick up when we look at a person and his mind, because of a home, of the because of all the practice he did in the earlier lives, that these things start to come up, visions of these you know, bodies decomposing in front of him. But like I said, these practices are just to encourage to balance our mind towards lust. If it brings up fear, then obviously not to do it. Yeah, within the practice that I recommend is something that to try. And then to see whether it works or not. And that's the thing. You know, like Ajahn Pling was saying, so much of it, our attachment to other people's body is actually the same thing. The more we attach to our body, the more we attach to other people's body. And vice versa. And you know, when we fall for other people, we fall in love or in lust, it's not so much, could be a sin, this is amongst you anyway, not so much that we're in love with the other person, but we're in love the way how they make us feel, this body, it's all back, it's all, you know, here. It's all about our own sense of self. And so the more we kind of detach from our own body, then the more we can kind of detach from the lust of other people's bodies. And when you don't have lust, actually true love can happen. Because then you don't have a sense of self that clouds everything you see. That you do have, you know, when, you know, monks and nuns, when we don't have, because we, you know, our celibate lifestyle, we don't have that one special person that we give our attention and love to. But that frees us to give attention, to love, acceptance to everybody who comes into contact with us, to the people around us. So instead of focusing this kindness and gentleness on one person or just a family, you know, if you practice, and as the monks and nuns lifestyle, you have this ability to, you know, to be able to treat all the people who come to the monastery as part of the family. Some that we really, really, you know, deeply care about, someone we want to protect and to help whenever we can. And that's the kind of the benefit of not having a focus, not having, you know, too much lust, that when you focus on one person, when you can radiate the sense of well-being, sense of care and compassion to all beings that we come into contact. And we take further, it's just not people that we have care and compassion for, it's in all beings, the animals that live with us, the people that we don't even see. I was thinking, I think there's a sutta somewhere that says the benefits of doing body contemplation. Is it? I can't remember. I'll go back. There's a sutta that says that doing the, I think 9 or 10 of doing metta contemplation, metta meditation. But I can't remember off the top of my head what are the different benefits of doing body contemplation. I'll get back to that. That's the thing, and a lot of times doing the contemplation, the nature of the body, yeah, some people do think that it's a bit too negative or too morbid, but this is where you have to take it on faith, that when I do hear the different meditation masters talk about body contemplation, they talk with great joy and happiness that when they did it. That bring a lot of deep sense of peace, a sense of coolness to the mind. It doesn't bring aversion or fear. And it's something that, you know, we just have to work with anything. You know, some different muscles, a different training that we have to start out and see, you know, where that takes you. Or you can also do, if you're, you know, your practice is to repeat things in your mind. Yeah, just to pick one thing. You know, hair of the head, kesa, hair of the head. And repeat it over and over again just to see what that does. And you used to walk around, just imagine hair everywhere. You know, sitting on a chair that's made of hair. Buildings of hair sticking out. Roofs are covered with hair. People wearing hair robes. Or hair shoes, hair, and then just imagine, and, you know, just work with it to see what hairs are like. And basically, yeah, hair is just hair, not beautiful, not ugly, just hair. So nothing to get too excited, or, you know, like I said, when you look at somebody, just look at their hair, or imagine their bowl without their hair, an attractive person, what would that look like? Is there anything? There's not a fixed way to look at the body. It was an encouragement to look at it from a different angle as we usually look at it. You know, someone's attractive or not attractive, young or old. Is this person, you like blonde or brunette, redhead? No, just look at it, you know, from another perspective. that's one of the way to use contemplation to still the mind. And that's as much as I comes up regarding the body contemplation. The other one I was topic was going to bring up to help with the stilling the mind. If your mind is not still, or if you know mindfulness of breath is not having a lot of great results just yet. Another way is to work with the thinking mind in a way that helps to slow it down, or just to be at peace when nothing's happening. 5 weeks into the monastery, into the rains retreat, even though on a certain level there's certain enough things to keep us going, the 2 work days and the sutta class certainly keeps me going, Dhamma talks, fixing things, Bindabat. But even so, there's comments, oh, it's boring. I'm getting bored, Ajahn. What do I do with boredom? And I think boredom is really great. Being a senior monk, I love being bored. When nothing's happening, I don't have anything to do. And boredom is, I think, sometimes is the reaction we get when we're not used to stillness. It's like when you're in a really bright room and you come out in the dark and you can't see anything. And you feel a bit uncomfortable. And after about 15, 20 minutes, the mind starts to adjust and your eyes start adjusting and you see the shade and stuff. And you see, oh, it's actually quite nice. It's not as bright as daylight, but it has its own beauty at night and you can see things, walk around. And it's the same with the mind. If you come from a kind of high impact, high activity, highly charged sense world of talking, computer, interneting, and Facebooking, and video games, and then come into a place, even though it might seem busy for the monks, come into a place that's nothing happening. It may seem a bit boring because the mind is looking for things to happen, looking for things to turn it on, looking for things to interact with. But I think when you are feeling bored, it's just, look at this, it's what happens, it's the mind looking at peace from negativity. And one of the things is just to sit with it. Yes, I'm bored. When we say we're bored, meaning nothing's happening, we want something to happen, something interesting to happen. We want something that we like, and we feel unsure, we're not used to nothing happening. So we're looking for things to happen. But we can turn it around, looking from a different perspective, and say, oh, it's great. Nothing's happening. This is what it should be. This is what peace feels like. Peace is like this. Yes, that's it. My mind doesn't really think. Maybe it chatters to itself a little bit, but not too much. Nothing to get excited about, nothing to look forward to. Oh, I'm going to whatever, go there tomorrow, eat this. I don't want to get involved in the food, when involved in the plans after the rains. It just wants to sit. And I think when we sit long enough and we accept that nothing's happening, then slowly the mind gets used to it and it appreciates the stillness and the happiness arises. And people, oh, this is great. Nothing's happening. Mind is becoming still. It's great that the mind's not moving, not looking for things to excite it, not looking for things to interact. Not looking for people to talk to, but happy. Happy to stay in the kuti, happy to be by yourself, happy that there's nothing to look forward to, nothing to look backward to, happy to stay in the present moment, happy to stay still. And yes, boredom is one of the many obstacles that we all have to face. You all have to find a skillful means to work with. And next time you feel you're bored, don't take the bait of Mara and run, reach for a book or reach for something to do. Because I certainly was a big victim of that in my early days. I came from a very highly active lay world. I was constantly doing something. Either I'm sitting meditation or doing my chanting. Or doing book, reading a book, Dhamma book. I have to do something. I'm doing. I'm always coming, doing something. And while obviously being a young monk, you know, there's certain chanting you have to know, obviously. There's certain books you have certain kind of Dhamma ideas that you have to get familiar with. So it wasn't bad. But it's true. But, you know, if you kept going, like kept going that with my monastic life, and you're constantly doing, and you find that monks are always doing. You're doing things. There's always a project. There's always a book to write. Talk to you. A retreat to lead. New kutis to build. New monasteries. New things to do. And hopefully after a while, we do get the hang of it. Yes, the things to do. But it's also nice. But nothing, when there's nothing to be doing. So we can sit at peace. And that's the reason why I encourage, you know, lots of group practice. Back to the group practice. That, yes, 2 o'clock, bang, sit. Why can't we sit still and watch the mind? 4 o'clock, why can't we sit still and watch the mind? You don't have to do anything, you're just sitting there. And it should be the easiest thing to do. But yes, some people find it very, very difficult. And there's a certain amount of suffering involved in group practice, I've been told many, many times. And yeah, I know, that's part of the practice. It's, you know, that we should have a way to work with the mind. Just said, okay, bang. That's the reason why you might think, oh, that's why, that's a good excuse Ajahn says for changing his mind 3 times a day, 3 times a minute. Oh, today we do this, or tomorrow we do that. Oh, actually, I changed my mind again, tomorrow we're doing something else. No, conditions change and things come up. But also, the practice that I was taught in Thailand, I think is a very valid approach, is, yeah, things are changing, and it's the practice that mainly is the practice, you know, is meditation is important. But also, mainly behind that, is the letting go of, you know, whatever the schedule is, yes, we do that. And we watch the mind. Does the mind like it, not like it? Why does it want to do something else? And just to see the sense of self that arises, that, no, I want to do something else. I think this is better for my practice. I want to do something different because I'm different. You see, watch that sense of self arising and working with that. And I don't know, I mean, with, you know, most people here, actually, you know, should be grateful that we're in a monastery. And boredom is a great thing. Imagine you're on the world, you have to work 8 hours a day. Sure, you won't be bored then. You'll be wishing you're back in the monastery. And that, you know, the people who come and feed us work at least 8 hours a day. And that hopefully we are worthy of the food that we're receiving. And that's, you know, trying to remind people, yeah, I know we both do, you know, certainly as a monk, that there is a duty. And there is no such thing as a free lunch. There is a karmic debt. Unless you're enlightened, there's a karmic debt that we owe to the people that come and feed us. That we make the best use of the food, make use of the robes, make use of the shampoo and the toilet papers and whatever else that we receive in abundance. That, you know, it's not an easy thing that comes by. People work hard, buy it, and give it to us. So it's a heavy karmic debt that we owed. And obviously not to feel guilty or, you know, kind of remorse about it, but certainly it's a responsibility that we should not take too lightly. That's why it's good to be, you know, frugal in our wishes. It's good to make the most of the things we have. Because, yeah, unless you're fully enlightened, you're in debt to all the people that feed us. It's a good reflection, you know, every night we make the most of our practice. We're just hanging out. Was it worthy of the special food that all these, you know, lay people worked so hard to bring? So that would hopefully, you know, makes us more energetic. Hopefully we sit a little bit longer. Hopefully we're a bit more restrained. Certainly we purify precepts a little bit better. So on this Saturday evening, in the middle of the rain somewhere, offer some reflections on the body as a way to calm the mind. It's a way to look, to process the information that we receive from the media. Also ways to lessen our lust and increase the well-being in our minds. Also some reflections on the nature of the mind, boredom, to celebrate it, to accept it, to work with it, instead of running away from it. And also a reflection on what's it like to be a monk, a person who lives in arms. Okay, I leave that for your contemplation tonight.
Namo Buddhaya. 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 Namo Buddha